academic community, Dean of Students, Ms. Prem Kupo, Senior Lecturer from the School of Translation, Christopher Fotheringham, the Chairperson of the Bhakti Yoga Society, Muzi Nantlawane, a very good evening to you. Welcome to the inaugural Bhaktivedanta Swami Lecture, hosted by the African Division of the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust, which is based in Taiwan, Australia, Los Angeles, Sweden, Rio de Janeiro, Mumbai, and convened here at this prestigious institution of learning, where Bhaktivedanta Swami himself lectured in October 1975. The Bhaktivedanta Book Trust is the world's largest publisher of books in Vedic thought, with translations in over 90 languages, including Chinese, Farsi, and Kiswahili. It seeks to bring an ancient message to the forefront of modern thinking. This is the first of an annual series of lectures intended to stimulate thinking and promote debate on the issues of the day. The first responsibility of any leader is to define what is reality. And so in training future leaders, an education system should empower, stimulate, and challenge us to explore what reality is. For example, when economic growth is pursued with reckless disregard for the environment, it leads to pollution that disfigures the landscape. Our immediate response is, due to our affiliation to nature, is to find some interventions to balance this out. So as human beings, we are full of capacity and instrumentation for deep introspective thought. And the words of Aristotle, and I quote, "The educated differ from the uneducated as much as the living differ from the dead." Bhaktivedanta Swami was perturbed by seeing this deadly combination of ignorance and disinterest, and emphasized the deep value of thoughtful education. And so it is precisely such deep introspective thought that the Bhaktivedanta Swami lecture seeks to invoke. Because to challenge the status quo to achieve the topmost benefit for humanity is the essence of education. Distinguished colleagues, today we have the pleasure of having with us a direct student of Bhaktivedanta Swami, His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami, who will deliver this evening's lecture on Where is Our Education Leading Us? He is an editor, a publisher, teacher, and has been a senior editor for the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust for the last 40 years. He is a strongly independent thinker and a respected scholar from the tradition that Bhaktivedanta Swami himself represented. Jayadvaita Swami is of Jewish descent, hails from the area of New York, where he became a full-time monk in 1968, some 45 years ago. He travels widely and has taught and lectured in over 50 countries. This lecture is scheduled to last for 30 minutes and will be followed by an open session. Thank you again for your attendance and interest in the subject of education. Now please join me in welcoming His Holiness again to our beautiful country and to this distinguished university of learning, His Holiness Jayadvaita Swami.
Ladies and gentlemen, distinguished guests, since this is the first Bhaktivedanta Swami lecture, let me begin by saying something about the person in whose honor it's been named and how what he taught is relevant to our topic today. His name is a long one, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Scholars most often refer to him more briefly as Bhaktivedanta Swami, or increasingly these days, by the name his followers most often use, Srila Prabhupada. I first met Srila Prabhupada in New York City in 1968. After a difficult journey on a freighter on which he'd received free passage, he'd come from India to America 3 years earlier at the age of 69. He had long since left behind him business and family affairs. And after years spent in study and writing, now he'd come to America with little more in his possession than a few rupees and some trunkloads of books. The books were the first three volumes of his translation with commentary of a great Sanskrit epic known as Srimad Bhagavatam, a book revered in India but little known in the West, a book of philosophy, of culture, practical knowledge, and above all, of spiritual understanding. Decades earlier, when Srila Prabhupada was in his 20s, his spiritual master had asked him to teach the message of this Bhagavatam and other related writings in English. So that was what Srila Prabhupada was now doing. The earliest of these writings, all in Sanskrit language, are known as the Vedas. And so the tradition of wisdom they represent is known as the tradition of Vedic wisdom. The word Veda, which literally means knowledge, comes from the Sanskrit root vit, to know, which is related to our English words wit and wisdom, but not to its water's rent. It was to teach this Vedic wisdom that Srila Prabhupada, in the last 10 years of his life, came to New York and later traveled 14 times around the world, including twice here to South Africa. It was also why he wrote a veritable library of books with titles now translated into some 90 languages, including French, German, Arabic, Zulu, Xhosa, Tswana, and Swahili. So what was this Vedic wisdom that Srila Prabhupada had come to teach? Why should we care about it? And what does it have to do with education? According to the Vedic tradition, education should aim at enabling us to achieve success in achieving four objectives: religion, economic development, the satisfaction of our needs and wants, and finally, liberation. This is not political liberation, but something far more important. And I'll come back to that later, to what that is. When we speak of the first objective, that of religion, this does not refer to a sectarian dogma or creed. The Sanskrit word here is dharma, and it refers to something broader and deeper. Dharma refers, first of all, to an essential intrinsic quality, what something or someone is meant to do. The dharma of water is to flow. The dharma of chili is to be hot. The dharma of sugar is to be sweet. And the dharma of a living being is to serve. The shopkeeper serves the customer. The worker serves the company. The doctor serves the patient. The teacher serves the students. The citizen serves the nation. And along with that, or on top of that, we all serve our senses. We serve the demands of our tongue, of our eyes, of our ears. They want to taste something, to hear something, and so on. And ultimately, our dharma is to serve God. As a hand is part of the whole body and is therefore meant to serve the whole body, every one of us is a part of God and therefore meant to serve God. Now, we all serve in some particular occupation, and that's another meaning of dharma. According to our natural leanings and skills, some of us serve as teachers, some as military and political leaders, some as farmers and businessmen, some as workers and technicians. The particular service we do is another aspect of our dharma. And while serving, we're meant to follow some basic moral principles: truthfulness, cleanliness, austerity, mercy. And this too is another aspect of dharma. Multifaceted term. Now, by serving in whatever our occupation, we should naturally achieve the second objective: economic development. We should have a roof over our head, clothes on our back, food on the table, money in our pocket. And so we can achieve the third objective. We can satisfy our needs and our desires. Then finally, we come again to the fourth objective: liberation. As I mentioned, this is not just political liberation, rather it refers to spiritual liberation, the liberation of the soul from material entanglement. And this is something our modern education wants nothing to do with. Soul, that's something that belongs to religion. What does that have to do with education? But when the Vedic sages speak of the soul, they're not merely talking religion. They're speaking of something fundamental, of the most essential object of inquiry. The Sanskrit word they use is atma, another word rich in meaning. It can also be translated as spirit or simply as oneself. To know our atma is to know who we ultimately are. And how can one be an educated person if one doesn't know who one is or doesn't even ask? To know what I should do with my life, I should first know who I am. And so the ancient Greek aphorism, know thyself. What is this self? For the Vedic view, we can turn to the Bhagavad Gita, the celebrated book of wisdom spoken by Sri Krishna. There, in Sanskrit, Krishna says, nasato vidite bhavo na bhavo vidite sataha upayorapi drishtontas twanyos tattvadarshi ki. That which lasts is unchanging, and that which changes never lasts. Those who are seers of the truth have ascertained this by studying the ultimate nature of both. Now, my body is always changing. At birth, my body was that of a baby. Then I grew up, and my body was that of a child, then a youth. And now I have the body of an old man. But while I've been changing from body to body, like a person putting on different sets of clothes, I've always been the same person. what lasts throughout all of these changes of body is the fact of my individual consciousness. And so the Vedic sages say, I'm not my body. I'm the spark of consciousness within the body. This way of thinking is not merely theoretical. It has consequences. Social, political, economic, personal. When I identify with this body, I think, I'm white. Or I'm colored, or I'm black, or I'm Zulu, or I'm Xhosa, I'm American, I'm South African. But the conscious self within the body is neither white, nor colored, nor black, neither Zulu, nor Xhosa, neither American, nor South African. For that matter, neither man nor woman. And therefore, when I think of myself and others only in terms of the outward body, not considering the inner self, I'm an illusion, an ignorance. And if I'm in ignorance, what does it mean to say that I'm an educated person? Once Srila Prabhupada was invited to speak at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, one of the finest of America's schools of higher learning. And to the students and professors who gathered to hear him, this is what he said. I see that in this institute you have so many departments of knowledge. Chemistry, biology, astronomy, physics. But where's that department to study the difference between a living body and a dead body? Within the living body is the force of consciousness. Within the dead body, that consciousness is gone, and no one can bring it back. The living body moves and acts because of consciousness. And therefore, within the body, consciousness is the most essential element. Where is the department to study that? But of course, there was no such department. We study nature, we study the world, but we don't study the conscious force that moves the world. We don't study the self. Instead, we just take it for granted that the self and the body are the same. We misidentify the self with the body. I'm white, I'm black, I'm American, I'm South African. And on top of that illusion, we build up our education, our science, our lives, our societies. And so we focus on that which is changing, and we lose sight of that which lasts. And when I think, in effect, I'm this body, I think of that which is related to the body, or that which I can grab for it, as mine. My land, my slaves or workers, my gold, my diamonds, my colonies, my empires. If something's mine, it's not yours. And so we compete for it. Each of us trying to hold on to what we've got and lay our hands on what we don't have. And this leads to conflict, to exploitation and injustice, to hatred and cruelty and brutality, to rioting, to war. Or else, we form partnerships and alliances. Why should this be mine or yours? Let's call it ours and divide it fairly. This is what Srila Prabhupada called thieves dividing honestly. What factually belongs to us? The land was here before we came. It will still be here once we're gone. So too, the people, the gold, the diamonds, the colonies, the empires. How are they ours? And if we claim as our own what's not ours, are we not thieves? And how will thieves divide their stolen property honestly? According to the Ishopanishad, a Vedic text, Ishavasya midam sarvam yatkin cha jagatyam jagat tena chaktena bunjita magritta kasya svitthanam. Everything within the universe, whether animate or inanimate, belongs to the person who ultimately controls them. That is, to the Supreme Lord. We should therefore accept only what we need for ourselves, what's set aside as our quota. And we should not grasp for other things, knowing well to whom they belong. Now, when I own and control something, I say it's mine. My wallet, my cell phone, my dog, my car, my home. But whatever I call mine is factually only on loan. It's mine for a while, not more. Even my body, which I certainly say is mine only for some time. And even then, I can't fully control it. I can't stop it from getting old, nor from dying. So finally, the grave or the funeral pyre takes it and says, it's mine. Yet here I am, thinking I'm this body, and claiming that whatever I can hold on to is mine. And because I can show a diploma, I'm an educated person. The architects of apartheid were certainly educated persons. And so too those who enforced it. But not from the Vedic point of view, because they were acting in the bodily concept of life. And that means ignorance. A Vedic verse says, those who follow a life of ignorance go downward into darkness. And still further into darkness go those engaged in the cultivation of knowledge. In other words, having wrong-headed knowledge, wrong-headed education, is worse than having no education at all. That's not to say that one shouldn't be educated, but education should make a person finer, not more foolish or more vicious. The person who's factually in knowledge, Krishna tells us, sees every human being, in fact, all beings that live, with an equal eye. When we see that the body is but an outward covering of the self, and we see that the true self is the spark of consciousness within, then we can see with that true equality of vision. And this is the vision of a truly educated person. such a person can factually attain liberation in the spiritual sense of the term. Liberation from the illusions of material existence. This doesn't require that one give up one's family or give up one's work. Rather, it calls for a change in understanding, a change in vision. From material, I'm this body, to spiritual. I am the lasting spark of consciousness within this body, and all living beings have the same spiritual nature. Welcome. When the Vedic wisdom speaks of all living beings, it offers a vision in which goodwill and fellowship are to be extended not only to all other people, white, black, or whatever, but even to the animals, to the birds, to the trees, to the fish, to all beings that live. They too have consciousness. They too have life. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna says that the learned person, the truly educated person, sees with equal vision the teacher, the cow, the elephant, the dog, and even the person who eats dog meat. Outwardly, these are all certainly different, but he sees within them all the same spiritual spark of consciousness. And so, Krishna says, by seeing that all other living beings are the same in essence as oneself, the learned person sees the true oneness of all living beings, both in their happiness and in their distress. Such a person is truly connected with God. I want to be happy, so do all other living beings, and just as I feel pain, so do all others. Why then should I not want all others to be happy? And why should I cause any other living being needless pain? And so, the Vedic aphorism, Sarve Sukhino Bhavantu, may there be happiness for all. In practical terms, this implies a change of diet, from a diet that relies on cruelty and slaughter to a diet gentle and humane. To inflict pain and suffering on millions of animals through wholesale slaughter, and then to expect friendship and peace and tranquility among human beings is to live in a fool's dream. According to the Vedic wisdom, one result will come to us when we follow a life of ignorance, that is, of supposed knowledge that fails to go beyond the bodily concept of life. And a very different result when we cultivate a life of true knowledge, knowledge that begins with an understanding of our own spiritual nature and the spiritual nature of all living beings. And so the Vedic wisdom says that one should gain both material knowledge and spiritual knowledge side by side. And in this way, one can go beyond material existence, even beyond death, and taste what the Vedic sages call the nectar of immortality. For the body, there's no question of immortality. And for the conscious self within the body, there's no possibility of death. That is what the Vedic sages have seen by carefully considering the ultimate nature of both. Both matter and spirit, both the body and the conscious self. In the Vedic view, since the conscious self is immortal, after the death of the body, it continues to exist. As we change bodies from that of a child to that of a youth to that of a person in old age, so at the time of death, we move on to a new body in another lifetime, in a continuous cycle of birth and death. Now I'm present in this room, and now you can see me. But it's not that I popped into existence only when I walked into the room, nor is it that when I leave the room and you no longer see me, I'll cease to exist. Before coming into this room, you know I was present somewhere else, in another room, and when I leave, I'll go somewhere else. And so it is with consciousness, with the self. Now, here we are, in our present bodies, all physically present. But before, we must all have been elsewhere. And when we leave, again, we must go elsewhere. No one can create consciousness, no scientist, no engineer, and no one can destroy it. So what happens to it? According to the Vedic view, it always exists and it travels from one lifetime to the next, being born, living out its life, then dying, and moving on again. And so it is that we're born into different circumstances, different families, sometimes rich, sometimes poor, sometimes healthy, sometimes diseased. Our circumstances in this life result from our actions in the life we had before, and our actions in the present life create the life we will have next. Just as what we do in grade school might make us eligible to attend a certain college, and how we apply ourselves in college makes a difference when we enter the job market. By our present actions, we create our future. And all that we do in the present life is summed up at the time of death. This is a large topic, and time prevents us from pursuing it here in much detail. But it's worthy of our further study, because the ultimate problem of human life is not one of those problems we find in our newspaper headlines. It's the problem each of us must face. Each of us must deal with, to which all the sages direct our attention. The problem of death, and what, in the face of it, each of us should do. Earlier in this talk, I mentioned that according to the Vedic tradition, education should aim at enabling us to achieve success in four objectives: religion, dharma, economic development, satisfying our needs and wants, and finally, liberation. In the Vedic view, the ultimate goal is liberation, and the other three objectives are stepping stones along the way. Through dharma, leading a moral life while working in a suitable occupation, we earn what we require to satisfy our needs and wants, so that we can pursue an understanding of our ultimate purpose in life, and taste, as the Vedic sages say, that nectar of immortality. That is the ideal of Vedic education. Vedic education endeavors not to stuff a child with knowledge, but above all, to build character, to instill the values of cleanliness, truthfulness, austerity, mercy. It promotes economic development, especially through a simpler way of life, in which we make proper use of nature's gifts and live in harmony with nature. In this way, it enables us to meet our needs, and it teaches us the art of being satisfied with what nature gives us, and not trying to scheme and exploit and bully our way into trying to get more at the expense of the lives and happiness of others. And it keeps always in view that our present life is temporary and that its true purpose lies in spiritual realization. But education as we know it today, quite a different story. Morality and personal character are of little concern. Liberation is out of the picture. The focus is squarely on economic development, making money, and for this, our education trains leaders to build an over-industrialized world where millions of people can toil in mines and factories so that a few can live in luxury, with the middle class in between to serve as emerging target markets and consumer units. With such an education, we focus on meeting our needs and wants, and not only meeting them, but expanding them, in the expectation that the more we get, the happier we'll be. This expectation is false, and therefore, the education we receive is a false education, leading us to work like donkeys, with the carrot of happiness always dangling before our face at every step, sure to be ours if we only can just catch up with it. Our poster for this evening's program mentioned that the World Economic Forum ranked South Africa's educational system as one of the world's worst. Of 144 countries, number 140. And a year ago, Mamphele Ramphele said, famously, that South Africa's educational system now is worse than the gutter education the country had under the apartheid government. But suppose that by some miracle of good government and educational reform, now we're really talking miracles. Suppose that Africa's educational system were to move up from the bottom of the list and join the ranks, if not of Switzerland and Finland and Singapore, numbers 1, 2, and 3, but then at least of the United Kingdom and the United States, numbers 27 and 28. Srila Prabhupada would say that this miraculously transformed educational system would still be a grand failure. Why? Because it would still be built on ignorance, on mistaking the body for the self, and on making the gratification of our bodily demands, the needs for eating and sleeping and mating and defense, the central focus of our life. the animals know of no higher purposes in life than to eat, to sleep, to defend themselves against attack, and to have sex. And of course, as human beings, we share these same needs. But human life is meant for a higher purpose. We may eat more nicely than animals in a restaurant or a hotel. We may sleep in a more comfortable bed. We may defend ourselves with guns and missiles instead of claws and teeth. And we may have sex with the aid of condoms and pills. And that may make us better animals, more polished animals, more sophisticated animals, but it doesn't make us more than animals. And human beings living as no more than animals will never be truly successful, nor even happy, to say nothing of achieving the ultimate goal of life. For that, we need a truly higher education, one that begins in childhood and extends throughout one's life, an education that enables us to understand, first of all, the difference between the temporary body and the permanently existing conscious self. We need an education that enables us to see that whatever exists in this world is not our property to be fought over or cleverly divided and exploited, but the property of God, the ultimate controller and owner of everything. We need an education that teaches us how to work in harmony with nature, not against it, by living a simpler life, meeting our basic needs by depending on nature's gifts. And we need an education that enables us to keep in view the ultimate purpose of human life, to rise above what's illusory to what's real, from darkness to light, from death to immortality. It was to promote this sort of education that Srila Prabhupada journeyed on that freighter to New York, that he came here twice to South Africa, and that he wrote so many books. The knowledge found in these books is like gold, and I dare say that it's more valuable than all the gold ever found in South Africa. And for this gold, no mines, no exploited workers, no ruinous environmental impact, no international competition. It's pure, and it's beneficial, and it's yours for the taking. This doesn't involve switching from one religion to another. Whatever our religion, whatever our culture, whatever our race, whatever our nationality, we can take advantage of this knowledge and benefit. Its value is universal, crossing all lines. Gold is gold, regardless of where it comes from. There's no question of Russian gold or South African gold, Hindu gold or Christian gold or Muslim gold. Wherever we find gold and whoever we get it from, it has value. So too with knowledge. The Bhagavad Gita says, there's nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge, the Gita says, is the king of education. And I invite you to give your open-minded consideration to this knowledge with the utmost seriousness. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'd like to give another hand of applause to the celebrants, please. That lecture had some very provocative statements. We in the audience are very intelligent persons, from academia and persons who are committed to higher values around education. And I would like to open the floor for an engagement with His Holiness. Maharaj, if you could just please sit there so they could see you. If you could just state your name when you ask a question and the institution or the affiliation you belong to, so everyone would know where you're from. So I'd like to open the floor for some questions. Yes, sir.
So I'm from this university. My question is sort of simple. You were talking about how if we were to suddenly improve our education system and to be at the top of the system as it currently is, it would still be a great failure. I understand you when you say that. What I wanted to ask perhaps is, do you have examples or of places that are succeeding in the way they educate their people, their societies, maybe even on a very small scale, something that we can look to as an example of how you would like things, how things should be?
Thank you very much. Good question.
Stand here, it's better.
I'd say first I can look back historically, and I can say that the books that I've been speaking about were part of a culture. They weren't just books. And back in that culture, this was the norm, that people were educated to understand this, that the teachers would be people of purity, of deep realization, of practical understanding, that the leaders would be people of enormous responsibility, who felt that the citizens were practically like their children, and needed to be protected and cared for the same way, where the farmers were actually the economic basis of society, not the nuts and bolts and petrol, but grains and fruits and vegetables, and where the farmers, instead of being representatives of some multinational demonic corporation, tended the land, cared for the land, cared for the animals. And where the workers helped in all of these other departments and were valued for their contribution. That's a culture which is in the past, which is we've lost touch with. But that's the culture that we want to bring back. On a small scale, we have schools. One especially comes to mind in Mayapur, in West Bengal, in India, where students are being trained in this way. There's a project in Congo. Not someone that I'm close with, but his mother used to be one of my authors in my magazine publishing days. He has a project in the Congo dedicated to village life, where there's enormous productivity by caring for the land and actually using animals for traction and work. So there's pieces, and you know, like seeds, you water them and they can grow.
Yes, we get your name on your
Are you a student here?
Yeah.
Do we have another question for the Swamiji?
Yes, right there.
Please don't forget to state your name and the institution you belong to.
Right back over here, I saw a hand. Am I right? Or are you pointing someplace else? There you are. Okay.
Good evening. My name is and I'm from Wits University. The most provocative statement you made was that excessive scholarship leads to more foolishness. So, if you have higher education, higher qualifications like a doctorate and anything like that. And earlier we saw that the qualifications of the master ceremonies is that he has a doctorate in business administration. So what I'm essentially asking is, how is it, in the Vedic concept, that you can have a high material education at the same time still be broad-minded and understanding yourself?
Dr. Singh is very suspect here. The idea is that education without self-knowledge is a shell. And that shell, what do they say? A little learning is a dangerous thing. A lot of learning is a more dangerous thing. If we don't know who we are, if we don't know who the world belongs to, if we don't know who others are, then what do? We use our education destructively. We use it on so-called defense, which burns up half the world's tax money. We use it on inventions that exploit and cause more trouble than whatever problems they're meant to solve. We become more proud. I have a degree. I have an advanced degree. I have 5 degrees. But I'm a dog, because I think that to eat, to sleep, to mate, and to defend myself is all there is to human life. So we're fine with education, with degrees, with science, with higher education in every sense, with spiritual knowledge alongside. I quoted earlier that the sages say one should cultivate material knowledge along with spiritual knowledge, both side by side. If you have one and not the other, you have imbalance. If all you know is spirit and you don't know how to grow a potato, you don't know how to eat, you don't know how to support yourself, you're in problems. And if all you know how to do is advance in your career, advance in your family life, advance in temporary values, you're unbalanced the other way. And that's what we have now. We have an unbalanced world with so much emphasis on the temporary, an educational system that's geared the same way. I was reading that Economic Forum report valued education because it produced good workers. Is that what your life is for, to be a good worker? You come out of here and you're eminently employable? That's fine, I'm not against employment, but for what? What is the purpose of my life? To work in a big bank and have a lot of stuff and then die? The same way that the poor man dies, the same way the dog dies. So both things must be there. Don't drop out of Ritz. But we have so much to balance your Ritz education. We have a lot of books. Okay?
Another question?
My name is Winter and I'm a graduate. My question is related to the four goals of life that you mentioned earlier. And one could argue that we are an academic institution, therefore we could be fulfilling the two goals of...
Therefore
we could be fulfilling or meeting the objectives of economic development and science communication, and therefore it can be other institutions' objectives to meet the other two of Dharma, liberation, spiritual realization, etc. What would be your response to that?
That this is an institution for academic education, and therefore it's appropriate that it focus on economic development and leave the other things to other institutions.
Yes.
I would say that that's creating a unwholesome fragmentation in our life. And unwholesome, because it's you don't want to separate your the parts of your body and feed one part and say, well, over here sometime they'll do something for another part. It's meant to be holistic. Education is not meant to be fragmented. Spiritual knowledge is meant... Take any course. Take science. Take economics. Take physics. If they're not spiritually informed, you have a problem. So science develops ideas that matter is everything, that there's nothing beyond matter, and doesn't take into account the role of consciousness, except as it impacts physical systems. It doesn't ask, what is this consciousness? Where does it come from? And if it does ask, it says, well, it came from little bits of chemicals, which is a bias. It's not that science shows that, has shown that, has produced all of these nice little living beings that it grew in laboratories from carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and potassium. But there's a certain worldview, a reductionistic, materialistic worldview, which infects our science. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada at MIT, a great scientific institution, said, where's the department to study consciousness? It should be integrated. Come to economics, the same thing. This Vedic literature is not just theoretical spiritual literature. It speaks to government, it speaks to economic development, it speaks to the kind of issues like spiritual equality that have been terribly missing historically in South African education. And there's a practical example. You have fantastic education, minus deep spiritual understanding. And what does that result in? It shouldn't be left to the side. Well, this is something we'll deal with in our spare time. This is the central focus. The other things are meant to support that. And if there's nothing to support, we make the foundation, the whole building, then we're missing.
You mentioned that South Africa is one of the worst education systems or education. I forgot to tell you, my name is Bruce, and I'm also a student here at Wits. You mentioned that South Africa has one of the worst education systems. I think you said number 144 in the worst. In what aspect is...
What was that ranking?
In what aspect is this... Is South African education one of the worst education?
Yeah, okay.
And also, I'd like to know what level of education are you talking about? Are you talking about... higher education.
Right.
Or you're talking about high school education going down to grade zero.
Good questions. The World Economic Forum's report is online, and they do break it up. They have ranking of primary education, they have ranking of higher education, and so on. And South Africa wasn't at the very bottom of all of them. And I forget the actual numbers. But then there was a table which just said the quality of the educational system, and it didn't make distinctions, didn't specify. And that's where it was 140 out of 144. Now, on what criteria? Very interesting. What mattered to them? How the education contributes to the economic development of the country. That was their standard. And that in itself tells you something. Here are these great world leaders, and that's what they're focused on. And that's fine, we need economic development. But that's so often as far as it goes. Economic development, and you know how many internet connections and how many cell phones per capita or per 1,000 people or what have you. And it's a thick report. You can read all the charts and see where all the countries stand and lots of different things. Their education, the perceived honesty of their leadership. I don't have a number for South Africa. I'm not saying anything. But lots of different points. But there was no quality that said ultimate value in life doesn't raise the issue. What are we living for? We're living for economic advancement. Maybe, I don't want to short these people, maybe they have some higher thoughts in mind. But that's what their report is about, to answer your question. I hope it does answer your question. Okay. If you wanted to drop an email to me, I could give you the figures for the other, for lower education and higher education. Why don't you speak real close into that microphone and we'll hear you better.
This is probably an argument to in favor of economic development. But my feeling is that sometimes government policy and the education within which dictates our policy, which dictates our education rather, are geared towards economic development, because especially in South Africa, we realize that without that kind of development, then a lot of people who are previously disadvantaged have less ability to then realize their potential as individuals and possibly even their spiritual consciousness because of the kind of conditions that they live in.
Yeah, fair enough. The educational system emphasizes economic development because we need it and because it's deficient. Okay. I'm for economic development. We said there were four goals. Economic development is one of them. The first one is Dharma. I'm not against Dharma. I'm not against economic development, nor against satisfaction of our needs and wants. My first question would be whether our scheme of economic development is really going to provide true prosperity. When you have an economic system that's really about industrialization, about workers, and about multinational corporations and their interests and international investments and so on, are we really getting freedom? Are we really getting fulfillment for our people? Or, in the name of solving the problem, are we getting ourselves deeper into problems? I come from a country which doesn't have this kind of background. And, okay, we have a super ultra strong economy, we have iPads coming out of our ears. But I don't see that now people have achieved their full potential and they're walking around the streets with smiles of contentment on their faces. It's like a fish, you know, you take him out of water and offer him a lounge chair and a cigar and opulent meals. He's not going to be happy because he's a fish. So meeting the needs of the outward body, although necessary, doesn't satisfy the needs of the person. That's the first point. If we don't go beyond that, we're missing what life is for. I'm prosperous, I've got a good education, I got a good job, I got a good house, I got a good home, and I died. And what did I live for? You get this tremendous emptiness, even in the most, you know, Finland, Singapore, and what was the third one?
Switzerland.
You know, I go to those places. It's not that their smiles are wider than in country number 27 and country number 28 or 104. But that's the first thing. And I would argue that real prosperity comes not from industry, from the land. You can't eat iPads, tractors, nuts and bolts. The real prosperity, the real basis of human prosperity is the land. Grains, vegetables, fruits, milk, cotton, silk, honey, everything that we actually need, nature provides. Timber, stone, it's all there. And we want to turn our back on the countryside, stuff everyone into Johannesburg and New York and Tokyo, and then, well, what are we going to do? Because the crime rate is off the charts, because pollution, and everybody's buying 100 new cars a year, and now we need more highways and more police and more this and more that. And life becomes better. It doesn't. So we would argue for a radical reexamination of what prosperity really is. Is it really skyscrapers and gadgets? In some senses, was South Africa more advanced in its original culture? I would say that in some ways it was. You look at New York City when the Red Indians had it, and look at the place now. It was better before. You can go up to the Hudson River and drink the water. No one dares do that today. In the name of prosperity, we ruin everything.
Forget to state your name.
My name is Wanda Kosi. I am with UNICEF, the Children of UNICEF. When you walk around the country on a Sunday, you see many people who are in various programs, obviously busy in pursuit of spirituality. There is a growing perception in the country that it is because they are unable to get onto the next level, which is that of economic prosperity. Could that be true? I'm saying it's a growing perception that when you can't make it, you rather stay with the spiritual goals. Is it true or not that you fall back on that?
It's true that
to stay with the spiritual, in pursuit of spiritual life, you're not moving on to the economic field.
The the religion
yes.
is
it's
primary. It's the beginning. It's the first thing. It just it's baseline. You want your people to be moral. You want your people to be truthful. You want your people to be honest. You want your people to be responsible in their lives. That's baseline. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. These are, you know, baseline things.
Except that, but I'm saying...
Then the next... Yeah, then...
I'm saying the problem is that in this country, and I could be generalizing here, you form the majority staying there, and most of them are unable to prosper in the next level, economic development.
Well,
I'm saying it's a growing perception.
Yeah.
What could be the reason for that?
Okay.
Could I have just reframe that question?
Yeah.
First question. Just tell me if I'm wrong, sir. You're saying that you see on the Sunday, many Christians pursue different types of faith, religion, etc. And you're asking the question, is it perhaps that they've reached the ceiling, they don't have the ability to move to the next level, so they just default to religion?
That's exactly what is happening.
Okay.
Check who's still there. Most of the time, they're unable to move to the next level.
Should the Swami get a job?
Should the Swami get a job and contribute something?
Let's look at a couple of things. I think it's good that on Sunday there's spiritual. I've seen also walking the streets that on Sunday so many people are on their way to some religious service, and that's fine. I'm not convinced that that means that people are sort of stuck on platform of religion. That the other 6 days they're absorbed in theology or worship. That's the first thing. I don't think the problem is that we're stuck, that everybody's just so busy in their spiritual life that they don't have time to earn a rant. That's not the problem. Even the problem is that when they go for their spiritual service, sometimes they're told, you know, just put your money in the donation box and your one rand will become 20. Right? And we see that the minister's driving, he's got the gold watches and the big car. So in one sense, your spirituality becomes just another business. Economic development for the preacher. So there's a shortage of this deeper understanding. That's what I'm saying. It's not a question of religion. It's not a question of whether you go to the Catholic Church or the Baptist Church or to the mosque or something else. Who do I think I am? Do I have that basic understanding? And what is my character? And then the next thing, economic development, is definitely necessary. Absolutely. But again, with an understanding of whose property it is that we're using, and with an understanding that it's worked out already. Now think about it. When a child is born, right away there's milk in the mother's breast. Who made that arrangement? So there was a government board that got together and decided this would be a good thing for the people? No, it's God's arrangement. You put a seed in the ground, and you add some water and some sunshine, which is already provided, and what comes out? And whose arrangement is that? My argument is that the necessary ingredients for economic prosperity are already there, and we're ignoring them or abusing them. I mentioned the animals. The animal industry, the industry of slaughtering animals for food. If you look at it, look at the numbers, it's one of the most wasteful industries in the world. The amount of food that you actually get you know, your output is tiny compared to your input. The animal eats so much grain, and you eat so much meat, and you pay. Like anything. It's one of the worst things you can do for your water supply, the amount of water that's used up in that industry, and all the disease. And, I mean, it's a terrible industry. And what to speak of the agony that's being caused to other living creatures. And it's not... It's totally contrary to nature's arrangement. By nature's arrangement, the cow will give you milk for free. You don't have to kill it. And the bull will give you work. You don't have to buy a tractor from America or the Soviet Union or some African country. You don't have to fill it with petrol whose price goes up and down according to the rand dollar exchange rate. You don't have to have factories with smoke coming out of them and going into your skies so that you have to have, now what are we going to do about the smoke? Bull provides traction. I mentioned this village project in Congo. They're working with oxen. The oxen, what's the input for the oxen? Food that grows from the ground, grains. And a farmer, you know, a family that could till 1 acre of land with their hands can now handle 10. And he was saying, don't get bigger than that. Don't go into, you know, thousands and thousands of acres. That's just, again, an exploitation system. 10 acres, where you were making $1,000, $2,000 a year on your 1 acre, with the help of the oxen and 10 acres, you're making $10,000 to $20,000 a year. And what does that do for the local economy? And without slaughter, without nasty factories, without punching time clocks, without living an unnatural way of life, without destroying the land, without having to buy this and that from outside, again, benefiting enormous corporations, your economic prosperity is already in the country, in the very land itself. That's the Vedic point of view.
We have time for a few more questions.
Okay.
We have to ask a question, and this one we cannot answer.
It shouldn't be hard.
Hello. My name is Mitchell. I'm a student at BITSE. I've got two questions. The first one, with these four goals that you've been talking about, are they necessarily a hierarchical system, or like where you have to achieve one before you move on, or do they all occur simultaneously?
Yeah, they should be concurrent. It's not that I just act according to religious principles and I don't make any money and I don't satisfy my needs and wants, and then I can never get to spiritual realization. They're meant to be all in sync, really.
Okay, thank you. And then, secondly, you've been talking quite a lot about moving back to an agrarian society. Mm-hmm. Given that about half the world is living in an urban situation, at least, and that most of us won't, won't actually move back to the land, how do you suppose that we can live in more with more of these kind of this philosophy and way of life in a city environment?
Yeah, good question. We can simplify. The modern way of life is so much about getting more, having more, doing more, better, but in the city even, we can simplify our life. We can eat, for example, a simpler and more humane diet. We can do without so many gadgets and so many things that we don't need. We can, the art is satisfaction. It's not that if I have 3 times more, I'll be 3 times more satisfied. But if I learn how to be satisfied with what comes of its own accord, I can have a happier life. And I can work less. No one wants to work all the time. You know, America's crazy. They're working two jobs. The wife is working, the husband's working, they're both working two jobs. And interesting statistic. 20 years ago, if the husband and wife were working, this is the United States Department of Labor, husband and wife is working, it's because they were struggling to stay afloat. Today, when the husband and wife are working, it's because they need that income to support their lifestyle. Very different story, isn't it? You know, the wife is working so that she can earn money, so that she can hire someone for daycare for her child. You know, backwards. Simplify. That's the Vedic message. Simplify, simplify, and don't look for your happiness in more things, more clubs and this and that. Look within. It's there. Okay.
So we have time for one last question before we break for a light group.
Good evening. I'm Loma Swazi. I'm a student from the Midrand Garden Institute, and I'm a student of psychology.
Okay.
You mentioned that how the society that we live, there's a whole lot of conflict amongst other people, with other people, and within ourselves, hence our lack of self-actualization and self-transcendence.
Right.
I just want to understand, do we create our own conflict as society, or does somehow God put us in like this conflict situation so we can realize His true power, His divine,
great question. Grace?
And one other question is...
Well, why don't you stop there, because I have a small mind, I can only handle one at a time. Yeah, is it that we've created our own conflicts by our own doings inside, or is it that conflict is already here in the world, put here by God so that we can realize Him? A little bit of both. The world is set up with conflict. I'm a dog, and so I'm going to chase the cat. I'm a cat, I'm going to chase the mouse. Conflict is built into this world, and there's no way that we're going to make it a world where conflict doesn't exist. It's built into the system. I want to live. And the world's set up in such a way that my body's going to fall apart and I'm going to die. There's no shortage of conflict. But we add to the conflict by ignorance, by unnecessary competition and hostility, by confusion within ourselves about what our life is for and how to be happy. And you're right, because you added a nice little point there, that it's God's arrangement also that this world is going to be miserable. So that we'll look and say, what in tarnation am I doing here? So we'll look at it and say, I'm in the wrong world. I'm spirit, I'm eternal. What am I doing in a place where everything is temporary? Is there something beyond this world? So it acts as an impetus for spiritual realization. Very good point. Thank you.
One other question. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, if you just sum it all up, if I were to sum this book up, it'll be about like simple living, I think. And is life really simple?
Is life really simple? Not usually. But My spiritual master used to say that it's simple for the simple and difficult for the crooked. By purification of our consciousness, by spiritual understanding, we can make our life simpler. Simpler in the things that we do, the whole physical endeavor that we're engaged in, and simpler within. I mean, I give you an example. I spend a fair amount of time in India, and in fact, in some village settings. And there's a kid, I suppose you have this in South African villages, it's probably villages all over the world. There's a kid, and he's got a stick, and on the end of the stick, there's a nail, and on the end of the nail, he's got a wheel. And he's pushing the wheel along with the stick, and he's having a great time. And the wheel cost him nothing, the stick cost him nothing, and the nail cost him nothing. And then you've got a kid who's got, multiplayer video games and all that. Is he happier? Is his life better? So it's practical. He's satisfied with something simple. And we teach him that, no, you have to have this, and you have to have that, and you have to have this, and you have to, be able to slay all these people in real time. And so, Srila Prabhupada taught that we can actually simplify our lives by spiritual knowledge. And he offered by chanting of the names of God. That will simplify our lives. He presented that. Probably, if you've heard of Srila Prabhupada, you've heard of the Hare Krishna mantra, which is nothing more than names of God. And his message was that by chanting these names of God, we purify our consciousness, we become more easy, we become satisfied with them. So on the one side you have something so easy to do that anyone without any education can do it, and on the other side you have a whole library of books for those who are looking for philosophy and analysis of so many things. But thank you so much.
So, Your Holiness, we thank you. Thank you very much for your wisdom and your provocative statements that has pierced the veil that covers what we call education. We'll now adjourn to the left-hand side or in front of us to have a light snack. Thank you very much for your attention. Very good evening.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Gunumzi Nontolane. I am doing my third year in accounting, and I'm the chairperson for the Bhakti Yoga Society. On behalf of the society, we would like to thank His Holiness Jayavita Swami, Dr. Ramchandra Singh, the BBT Africa team for helping us and engaging us in this beautiful program. As a token of appreciation, we would like to present these gifts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Whose recorder is this? Is it Marang?
Hey, carry camera. With us, huh?
Thank you very much.
It's like the gods are not the same. So like
how are gods?
Allah and Yahweh, those are not the same people. So they have.
How are they not the same person?
Because they define differently, or not define, or the books they talk about them talk about the characters. Okay, the characters are not the same.
But that may
you
be
what I mean.
Because I write a book about you, and your character is described one way. Your sister writes a book about you; it's described another way. Your father writes a book about you; it's described another way. You're the same person.
But it's consistent throughout. So they're not contradicting each other.
It's consistent.
It's consistent.
God is the creator of everything, whether you go to Christianity or Islam or Hinduism or you name it. He's the goal of life for everyone. He's full of... You can actually... Vedic literature has a good analysis. Who is God? He's the person who's supreme in strength. Right? He's the person who's supreme in knowledge. Right?
Yeah.
He's the person who's...
Omnipotent, omnipresent.
Exact, in strength.
Benevolent, and just, yeah.
He's the supreme in fame. Yeah. No one's more famous than God is. He's the most beautiful. No one surpasses the beauty of God. He's the wealthiest. He owns everything. Beauty, fame, wealth, strength, knowledge. And he's the most detached also. He gives the whole world to us and says, all right, you know, you play there. So these things are common. It's not that one religion will say God's the wealthiest, and some religion will say, no, God's not the wealthiest. Nelson Rockefeller's the wealthiest. Or Oppenheimer. Harry Oppenheimer's the wealthiest. Yeah. The person who has the most wealth, he's God. The person who has the most wisdom, he's God. The most strength, the most beauty. This is common. Come on. It's okay. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense to me.
It doesn't. We have to pick up the thread that's common to all. Just like, okay, in India maybe people dress like this. In Africa, you know, there's a traditional dress, and then there's, you know, modern dress. Common thing is you have to be dressed. Right? You want to cover your body. You want to not get rained on or burned up by the sun. So the common thing is dress. Now, that someone dresses this way and someone dresses that way is secondary. That differs according to the time or the place or the circumstances. Just like a woman should be dressed. Now, what she dresses with, that's secondary. So religion is like that. There's so many rules and regulations according to the place, according to the time, according to the people. You follow a whichever one you want. But the essential thing should be here. I should develop my spiritual understanding. I should develop my relationship with God. Then my religion. Otherwise, what am I doing with my religion? I'm following all these rules and regulations. I'm doing all the things they say, and I'm not getting the result.
I'm not really getting to know God. But I'm not really getting to know God
exactly
throughout these whole things.
Then what's the use of my religion? You know, it's like I've started a business and I'm working day and night, but I'm not making any money. So what's the use of being in business? The goal should be achieved.
Yeah, actually, that makes sense. That makes sense, actually. And would you say in your spiritual walk, do you feel the presence of God? Because I hear some people say that sometimes in some religions, so I just want to know.
You know, in our practice, the main thing we do is chant the holy name of God. I mentioned that.
Yeah.
Maybe you've heard
Krishna.
This. Yeah. And you can take any name. We have this name Krishna, which means all attractive. So it's like a universal name for God.
So Krishna could be Allah or Krishna.
Krishna
could
is Allah. He is
Yahweh.
Jehovah. He's the same person. It's not that there's 700 gods floating around. There's one. And Krishna, he has so many names. You know, like water, it's water, it's jal, it's agua, it's, you know, so many names. But it's water. So God has so many names, but he's God. So our main practice is to chant the holy name of God. And when you chant the name of God, then God is present by sending. And you will feel that. That's why we're chanting. You've heard the mantra? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama. Rama, Rama, Hare Hare. That's what we're chanting. And that we experience God's presence by that sound. See, I even have someplace down here. Deep in here is a box. And deep in the box are some cards. And on the back of the card is the mantra.
And this is sort of like worship.
Sure. That's what we're meant to do, is worship God. That's our relationship. God is great, and we're small. So we should worship Him. But more than worship, serve. Because worship, you know, is something like we go to church and do on Sunday, or we go to the mosque and we do, you know, on schedule. But service is something we can do all the time. To serve God with devotion is something you can do all the time.
And also, do you genuinely feel at peace?
Yeah.
Do you feel at peace?
Oh, you'll see I can say what my life was before and what it is now, I would not trade it.
Yeah?
Oh, no way. No way. And besides, the food's real good. Okay. You're a student here at Ritz?
Yeah, I'm a student, John, actually.
Okay. Have you been to any meetings of the Bhakti Yoga Society?
I was at one, I think last week. They had a talk about, it was about anxiety and fear, talking about fear. And why do you suffer? And that lady kept mentioning Krishna a lot. But I thought it was one God, like when people in Muslim talk about Allah. So that's what I...
Yeah, you thought it's like, yeah, they've got one and they've got one. And
that's another religion where they talk about Krishna. That's where I first heard the mantra, when she was talking. She was talking about expressing God through sound, like what you were saying.
So now you have a better sort of sense.
I'm just trying to learn more. I'm just trying to find out more. That's why I also came here especially. Because I just really want to know more and just find out more.
You are good. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for traveling so far just to...
No, it's my pleasure. And then my duty also.
Have some refreshments? Yeah, I'll have some. As ordered as a vegetarian.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a little demonstration of how many things you can do with just with vegetables and grits. 100%. Made with chickpea flour and vegetables inside, and then it's fried. You'll see.
Okay.
try a little of, you know, whatever attracts you. And if you want more, try more.
Okay. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Good question. Thank you very much. That was a serious scholarly question. You know, like, okay, you're given these numbers. What are they about? by what yardstick?
Salt, you know, when I had that.
Yeah,
140
out of 144. Quite a number.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, but I didn't have time. Religion and spirituality.
Uh-huh.
Because for me, somehow I could be wrong. It sounded like you were using the two words interchangeable.
Not really.
In my understanding, there's a huge difference between religion and spirituality.
Definitely.
Because like you'll ask someone, are you religious? And they'll say, no, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual.
Yeah.
Of which that's what I will always say if you ask me.
Yeah.
Because I believe that religion is basically a certain... Once you start talking religion, you're saying there are different groups of people who believe in different ways and worship in different ways, and that's what makes religion.
Yeah.
But in terms of spirituality, for me, the way I understand spirituality is that I would say I'm spiritual because I'm more concerned. I'm not against religion, but I'm more concerned about my relationship with God, because I was created in His image, and because of the defilement of sin from all the other generations before me, I am this corrupt person that I am now, and one of my purposes is to work towards going back to the original image that God created in me.
Yeah.
And the only way I can achieve that is to develop a relationship between me and God.
Exactly.
A personal relationship with God. Of which religion doesn't... Not that it doesn't allow that, but it doesn't entertain that, and it doesn't accommodate it, even though there are some few aspects of spirituality in all the different religions. But a religion is not there to promote the personal relationship between you and God.
And it's useless. There's a
No, I'm not saying especially, I'm just generalizing.
No, but I agree.
Yeah, I'm just generalizing. Because the religion is mainly concerned about their own beliefs or doctrines.
Competitive people in the market.
Your personal relationship with God in some religions, yes, it is promoted, but not as much as maintaining the image of a specific religion and the doctrine.
That's why.
And the only way you can survive in that situation is not to see yourself as a religious person, even though you belong to a specific religion, but see yourself as a spiritual person and focus on your relationship with God.
Exactly.
So that you can go back to the original image that He created in you when He said, let's create man in our own.
Exactly. Religion in that sense is like superficial. I can change from being a Christian, from a Protestant to a Catholic, from a Catholic to a Buddhist, from a Buddhist. And that's, you know, temporary.
Yeah, it's very temporary.
And it's, you know, on the surface. But my relationship with God is the essential thing. That's eternal.
Because He's your creator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. We're even more than creator, we're like parts of Him. So the relationship is integral. So there's a very good verse in one of our books that says that, what's the best religion?
What's the best?
The best religion.
Okay.
And it doesn't say Hindu or... The religion is best by which you develop your love for God. Without any motive or without any impediment. That's the best religion. That's what religion is about.
Swamiji, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hare Krishna to you.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll see you soon.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
I mean, one One of the things I believe is that when you were talking about happiness or satisfaction, one of the things I believe is that in order to find happiness, and this is also my definition of success, is to become the person that you would like to be with.
The person that you?
To become the person that you would like to be with.
Oh. Yeah. Well, it depends, because sometimes the person that you want, that some people want to be with, isn't the kind of person that, you know.
Exactly, that's the point. Because if you're not happy with the person that you are with, which is yourself, so you need to find a person. You need to find the true person that you want to be. That's why I agree with the first point you made, that when you said, be thyself.
Yeah.
Because you may be who you are, but you're not really happy with who you are. So you need to find who do you want to be, or who do you want to be with? Because you are always with yourself. You could be surrounded by people, but you're always with yourself.
Well, you know, one way of looking at it, you know, in one sense, that's kind of how I got into this, because I met my spiritual teacher, and I said, I'd like to be like that. Now, here's a person whose goals are not, you know, where's the paycheck, where's the followers, his goal is to serve the Supreme, to serve God.
To serve God and humanity.
And humanity. Well, for him, humanity, when you serve God, your service to humanity will all automatically follow.
Oh, yeah.
But if you just try to serve humanity, it's like watering the leaves of a tree, you know, the tree will never get watered. You've got to go for the root.
Yeah.
So, I think it, you know, somebody likes, you know, they want to be like, you know, a great gambler, you know, that's the person that I'd like to be with.
Yeah.
You know, so, it's a choice there. But if, from one point of view, if we can find a person who's genuinely God conscious and aspire to be like that, then our life will be successful.
Because you inspire to be like God.
Yeah.
Because that's how you were created in the first place.
Yeah.
And you were happy, you were free.
Yeah. Well, our spiritual master used to say that one could become great by serving the greatest. God is the greatest, and when we serve God, we become great.
Can I run a statement for you guys?
Sure.
And I just like to hear what you have to say about that. What if you're doing everything, which is my plan, what if everything you do is experience and, how do I say it, to experience and give love. So that's the point of everything you do. How far is that from the truth?
We want, in one sense, that's everything. But then where do we look for that? In bed?
That's another thing.
You know, in a casino? You know, everybody's looking for love. So, I mean, that's what we want. We live for love. But, you know, the whole world, you know, I mean, I go from one lover to the next lover to the next lover, and, you know, I'm disappointed, and I'm cheated, and I'm frustrated. But when you come to God, that's where you find unlimited love.
The main thing is to love God.
And selfless. We're looking for love where there's, you know, everybody's talking love. And it's just cheating, you know. I say I love you so that I can get something from you. And you say the same thing.
Picture,
please. Picture.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll all be in the picture, right?
Yes, we'll all be in the picture.
Okay.
Kebanasima.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
That was three, but that's okay.
I took your email address, by the way, from one of the students from the Baptist Society.
Sure, drop me a note.
Yes, and then I'll send you an email. And then you can send me those...
Oh, the numbers.
Yes. And your lecture, is it possible to get it like on email?
Yeah, it's already online, I've heard.
Oh, is it? On the same website that's on the program?
Let me find out. Mufundo. You know Mufundo?
I just saw the name.
Okay.
I know how he looks like because he was.
I'll find him.
But it's fine. I will.
If you drop me a note, even today,
yes.
I can drop you a note tomorrow and say where it's posted.
Okay.
So I think they got the text online already, and probably by tomorrow, the next day, they should have the audio online. Also.
Audio online as well. Okay. All right. Thank you. It was nice talking to you.
Nice talking with you.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you again. Jai. Good. How are you doing?
How come you're not in Mayapur this year?
I'm usually in South Africa at this time.
Oh, really? I thought maybe because of the
conference? I'm not a GBC man. Why do I have to go there?
Okay.
This is more fun.
And can I make a... Usually I don't have questions. Usually I have statements, and I'm hoping that... Could ask some questions. I always hope that you might answer my questions for a statement. And
sure.
The other thing I've realized is that I enjoy writing, like literature. I enjoy that.
Fantastic.
But I'm also good at mathematics and science, so I chose to get into engineering instead of writing.
Uh-huh.
So I write part-time and study engineering. But
maybe you'll wind up writing books about engineering.
Yeah, hopefully. But I like creative writing the most.
Uh-huh.
I really like description and stuff like that. But what I've noticed is that I feel it was a good decision, because what I've noticed is that engineering and science is from spirituality. Like I've been looking at some of the concepts we're studying right now in thermodynamics about the concept of entropy, how with increasing entropy, your net work is decreased. I mean, it's very normal, basic. I mean, if you're moving around a lot, if you're at a higher state of chaos, obviously you do less.
Yeah.
And it's so it baffles me how the scientist, let's call him that, cannot see that all his knowledge is from the spiritual world.
Yeah.
All his theories, all his concepts and his maths. And his...
There's a book by one of my colleagues who's a mathematician called Mechanistic and Non-Mechanistic Science, in which he essentially follows that theme, that, you know, why this tendency in science to try to flatten everything down to just material laws and not see, you know, a higher control, higher truth.
It baffles me how some of the smartest people who educate us cannot see that all their concepts
because
are
the
actually
biggest,
from...
They're the people we were talking about,
yeah.
Who are so educated that they're fools.
Yeah. But it's very interesting.
Are you in touch with the Bhakti Yoga Society here?
No, I'm not.
They have.
I'd like to.
Yeah, because they have regular speakers, and they address a lot of these topics. They have books, and they have a library here. So, just looking to see. If you see somebody, I guess, with a name tag, you can get more information about the society. That's a good place to get more.
I'm writing a book right now.
Oh, I'm writing one also. Pardon? I'm also writing.
Is it? Yeah, that's very nice. That's really cool. It also addresses concepts like that.
Uh-huh.
And stuff like what I've noticed is that I found a way to apply the stuff that I learned in engineering on a day-to-day basis. Like the other thing we learned in thermodynamics is that the energy in the universe is constant. That was very, very interesting once I started growing in that, and then I realized that that everything that happens, usually some of the physical things that happen are people, the energies we emit and the energies that radiate onto us. And
we have a lot of books actually written by scientists and students of science,
yeah,
and that we publish. You might find them interesting.
Is it?
Is there,
going to the website?
I think if you come to our website, you'll find things. And again, if you come to the Bhakti Yoga Society, they can direct you, know which books will have what you're looking for.
Yeah, because you can sort of get the feel of what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, yeah. And they can point out to you, this book will be good, this book will be good.
Yeah. I'll look at the website.
Yeah. I think they even have a library here, where they lend books and stuff.
Is it?
I think so.
I'll try and find out.
Yeah, there's a room here that belongs to the Bhakti Yoga Society.
In this building?
Oh, I don't know if it's this building, but on campus.
But I've seen you guys around,
yeah,
during the lunches, but I've never been. I just come to listen to the music.
Uh-huh.
I love the music.
Fantastic.
Yeah. But I'd like to learn more.
Very good.
That's a very interesting concept.
We're at your service.
I'd like to learn more.
Get some refreshments?
No, I will.
Yeah, don't miss out.
And the one thing, what did I want to say?
Okay. I'll get some. Come back to me?
Yeah.
Hi, how are we doing? Okay.
Enjoy the lecture a lot.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What are you studying here?
Law. What I'm studying with UNISA.
Oh, at UNISA.
Yeah. But I'm part of the Bhakti Yoga Society.
Oh, fantastic. What's your name?
Pula.
Okay, nice to meet you.
Same day. So you live in New York?
Well, I travel around, actually. I'm not in New York very much at all these days. About 4 or 5 months a year in Africa. And about 2 months, 2 or 3 months in India. A little bit in Europe. Most of the time in America and a little bit here and there.
Oh, all right. So which other countries in Africa do you go to?
Nigeria, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Togo, Botswana, Kenya, Egypt. Those are the ones I've been to so far. No,
Swaziland.
Oh, and Malawi.
Malawi. You see a huge difference between the countries in Africa.
Oh, yeah. Every place is a different place.
Oh, all right. Where they are African countries, both of them. Where they are all African countries.
Well, they're all African countries. And in many ways they're different. In many ways the whole world's the same.
Yeah. Also.
Sociology, so that's why I came to Bhakti Yoga to relieve me. When I came to this, the first thing was the Bhakti Yoga for me to be conscious and very strong, because we have these debates with some politicians. I'm a community builder. I'm a community builder back in Soweto. I help people with issues and all these devastated issues that happen and affect them, because people are traumatized and some of them they've lost it, and some of them lack education and they don't really raise it. And with our ruling party again, it's got issues, which it becomes tough.
Are we getting chased, or they just lost the light switch?
Yeah. So with issues, I'm living. You know, the area where I live is terrible.
Where do you live?
I'm in Soweto, Maryland.
Uh-huh. We have a center in Soweto.
But which part of Soweto?
I'm not sure.
Because the other thing I would like to ask is about this.
Especially.
Because I would like to invite them when I've got workshops about it. Because the law school might come to the institute. And apart from that, I need to teach our academics back here. Because they've lost conscience. Some of them are underestimating society, which some of us I come from my lady roots.
That's a beautiful car. Thank you.
I agree. Thank
you so much. It's also in the delivery.
Hare Krishna, Hare Bol. Hey.
I'm getting on the report.
I'm gonna actually take what you said and put it into practice. That's another thing.